This is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, relatives of abducted Iraqi soldiers storm parliament. The United Nations expresses alarm about Israel's decision to take over land in the West Bank near Bethlehem. We'll have reaction.
Actually, most land that has been expropriated since 1979 is still not settled with actual settlements, actual buildings and people.
And the internet and new technology offer new tools for journalists. It's all ahead. I'm Sarah Williams. Angry relatives of Iraqi soldiers who were abducted by Islamic State militants in June have stormed the country's parliament. Officials said the relatives were refusing to leave the building today and the police were trying to remove them. Earlier today, rights group Amnesty International said Islamic State militants in northern Iraq have carried out ethnic cleansing on a historic scale in a bid to wipe out non-Arabs and non-Sunni Muslims. A new report says the systematic campaign includes mass killings and abductions that have terrorized all of northern Iraq and is fueling sectarian tensions in the region. Well, United Nations Secretary General Ban Ki-moon has given tacit backing to Australia's plan to airlift weapons to Kurdish forces trying to fend off the Islamic State in northern Iraq. Canberra intends to deliver arms and munitions within days. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
Prime Minister Tony Abbott said Australia didn't want to be involved in another Middle Eastern war, but would do what it could to avert potential genocide. To try to halt the advance of Islamic State fighters in northern Iraq, Australian military aircraft will fly weapons and ammunition to outgunned Kurdish forces. The mission is being planned with the cooperation of the Iraqi government. Britain, Canada, France and Italy will also join the US-led mission. Mr. Abbott has said that Australian F/A-18 Hornet fighter jets were ready to support US airstrikes against Islamic State militants if requested by the US and Iraqi governments. Mr. Abbott has told the Australian Parliament that the world must stand up to Sunni militants spreading terror in Syria and northern Iraq.
Madam Speaker, I refuse to call this hideous movement Islamic State because it's not a state, it's a death cult. So in good conscience, Madam Speaker, Australia cannot leave the Iraqi people to face this horror, this pure evil, alone.
Tony Abbott's stance on Iraq is supported by the main opposition Labour Party. But Greens Party leader Christine Milne has demanded a full parliamentary debate.
The Prime Minister must tell Australians on what basis are we running after the United States into another imbroglio into Iraq.
Speaking in New Zealand Tuesday, UN Chief Ban Ki-moon said the UN Security Council should discuss ways for the international community to help resolve the crisis in Iraq. He said it was important to contain the further spread of political instability and security instability. Mr. Ban also thanked nations, including Australia, that were taking decisive action to address the threat posed by Islamic State fighters in northern Iraq. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney, Australia.
Well, the United Nations Secretary General Ban Ki-moon has called for political dialogue between Russia and Ukraine as a solution to the crisis in Ukraine. Mr. Ban made his remarks while he was in New Zealand, a day after Ukrainian separatist leader Andrei Porgun said he's ready to discuss a ceasefire and prisoner exchange. Porgun spoke at the first round of peace talks that opened Monday in the Belarusian capital, Minsk. The leader of the self-proclaimed Republic in Donetsk and the pro-Russian separatists said they are willing to remain part of Ukraine if they are granted more autonomy. The United Nations Monday expressed alarm by Israel's decision to expropriate 400 hectares of West Bank land near Bethlehem. Secretary General Ban Ki-moon in a statement said seizure of such a large swath of land risks paving the way for further settlement activity, which is illegal under international law and runs counter to the pursuit of a two-state solution. The United States Sunday criticized the Israeli decision as counterproductive to Israel's stated goal of a negotiated two-state solution with the Palestinians. Israel says the decision is in reaction to the June kidnapping and murder of three Israeli teenagers near Bethlehem. Israel has named three Palestinian suspects. Middle East analyst Michael Fishbach of Virginia's Randolph-Macon University tells VOA's Victor Beatty, if previous land appropriations are any guide, development may be a long way off.
Actually, most land that has been expropriated since 1979 is still not settled with actual settlements, actual buildings and people. It's held, in a sense, in reserve, and I think that's really some of the goal. Traditionally, when there have been various attacks on Israelis, settlements have been erected. I'm thinking, as many Israelis have, about the murder of three Israeli teenagers who were inside the West Bank several months ago. So that's a predictable reaction. But whether there will actually be buildings used, erected on the land, remains to be seen, because much confiscated Palestinian land has still remained unoccupied. However, they still constitute parts of the so-called settlement zones that Israel has always sought to include within the boundaries of a future Israel after some kind of final settlement. So even if they don't go ahead and erect buildings, it's still carving out more of the West Bank and essentially moving it over, figuratively speaking, on the other side of the wall to become part of Israel someday.
So what does this do to the peace process?
Well, I'm sorry to have to be so candid, but the peace process has been dead actually for a while, really. When Secretary of State Kerry reached the end of his efforts in the spring, it was merely another end to another beginning of a process that has seemingly been never-ending. Now, certainly many people around the world see that as representative of the fact that certainly the parties, a lot of people, the Palestinians would say it's the Israelis, whatever, aren't really working toward a process, that the process itself is the process of ongoing talks. Now, one doesn't have to subscribe to that, but the facts a lot of times do seem to square with that idea, that at some point, people have to get serious and say, is there really going to be a solution or not? But holding talks in order to have more talks about more talks, I think the Palestinians have given up on that. I think Secretary of State Kerry absorbed a lot of diplomatic damage from his inability to get beyond that. So I don't think it can hurt, frankly speaking, it can hurt the peace process much more than it's already hurt these days.
Michael Fishbach of Randolph-Macon University. Chief Palestinian negotiator Saeb Erekat denounced the land seizure Sunday as part of what he calls Israeli crimes against the Palestinian people and their occupied land. According to the British newspaper The Guardian, some 500,000 Israelis live among 2.4 million Palestinians in the West Bank and East Jerusalem on territory captured during the 1967 Arab-Israeli War.
China is a fascinating country
with interesting people doing amazing things.
Every Friday, we focus attention on some of our favorite things coming out of China during the previous week.
It may be political, it may be cultural.
It may simply be a curiosity that caught our attention.
But we'll find stories sure to be of interest.
And then, of course, we'll add our own American perspectives as well.
I'm Sarah Williams.
I'm Jim Stevenson.
Join us for China Focus every Friday at 12 hours Universal Time on VOA Radio.
And anytime on the web at voanews.com and on Facebook VOA Asia.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. The leaders of Hong Kong's pro-democracy Occupied Central protest movement are admitting they may not be successful at getting China to enact electoral reforms. The acknowledgement of two of the group's senior organizers comes after Beijing announced Sunday it will censor candidates for the territory's 2017 election. Occupy co-founder Chan Kinmon said today that Beijing will not likely reverse its decision. He said the goal of achieving universal suffrage is close to failure. It appears to be a reversal by the group, which has threatened to shut down Hong Kong's financial district if Beijing did not promise free elections. Pakistan's parliament is holding an emergency session to rally political support for Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif, who is refusing to resign despite weeks of opposition protests. Addressing the opening meeting, Interior Minister Chaudhry Nisar Ali Khan slammed the protests as a revolt against Pakistan being led by fake revolutionaries and terrorists. Ayaz Ghul reports from Islamabad as the protest leaders refuse to leave unless their demands are met.
Thousands of protesters have occupied a central part of the Pakistani capital for more than 2 weeks, demanding that Prime Minister Sharif resign over alleged election fraud. They had been mostly peaceful until Saturday, when protest leaders called for a march on the nearby building that serves as official home and office for the country's chief executive. That move prompted police to fire tear gas and rubber bullets to force the protesters to retreat. The security crackdown left at least 3 protesters dead and wounded hundreds of people, including police. Tensions escalated early Monday when a group of protesters stormed the nearby headquarters of the state television, briefly forcing its broadcast off the air. The attackers, armed with clubs and many wearing masks, allegedly caused massive damage to the property before Pakistani troops arrived to force them out of the building. Sporadic clashes between protesters and security forces also have continued. Later in the day, Prime Minister Sharif met with leaders of parliamentary parties, including opposition groups not supporting the demonstration, to assure them he will neither resign nor go on leave. The meeting took place amid widespread perception that the powerful military is secretly backing the protesters to force Mr. Sharif out of power. An army spokesman denied these suggestions on local media, saying it has nothing to do with the political standoff. However, skeptics like famed Pakistani human rights activist Asma Jahangir say the street protests resemble past actions that led to direct or indirect military interventions in Pakistan.
I think that what we are going to see in the next few days is going to be a change. There is no doubt about it. How much the parliamentarians will be able to resist it, and whether they will be able to manipulate that change according to their wishes, or whether there will be a complete change according to the wishes of the military. Because at this time, the protesters, they are out of the game in the sense that they have done their job.
The United States on Monday urged all sides in Pakistan to refrain from violence, saying protesters have a right to peacefully demonstrate. The U.S. State Department cautioned that Washington strongly opposes any efforts to impose extra constitutional change to the Pakistani political system. Opposition politician Imran Khan, who leads the third largest political bloc in parliament, and a fiery anti-government Muslim cleric, Tahirul Qadri, who has a large following in and outside Pakistan, have separately organized the anti-Sharif agitation. Khan believes last year's parliamentary elections that brought Mr. Sharif and his party to power were massively rigged, and he is demanding a fresh vote. The cricketer-turned-politician also has repeatedly denied the army or its intelligence units are backing him, insisting his democratic agitation has been peaceful and Saturday's police crackdown on his supporters was unprovoked. Qadri wants the dismissal of the Prime Minister and Pakistan's democratic system, insisting it is mostly designed to help the corrupt and powerful win elections. However, most local and international observers say the May 2013 polls in Pakistan were largely credible. Ayaz Ghul for VOA News, Islamabad.
Thailand's military and police have suppressed the release of an independent report assessing human rights in the kingdom during the first 100 days of the latest coup. A panel discussion on the topic was cancelled by the organizers, fearing arrest if they did not comply with a letter from military leaders telling them not to hold the meeting. VOA correspondent Steve Herman has more from Bangkok.
As organizers were explaining to reporters why they felt it prudent to cancel a human rights panel discussion and delay the release of a report on freedoms, police officers entered the Foreign Correspondents Club of Thailand. A policeman handed copies of what was termed a request for cooperation from the 1st Cavalry Division of the King's Guard, acting on behalf of the National Council for Peace and Order. A policeman tells the 3 panelists from Amnesty International, the Thai Lawyers for Human Rights, and the Cross-Cultural Foundation, He has a personal copy of the letter for each of them. The letter asked them not to hold the human rights event. Martial law was declared in Thailand 2 days before the May 22nd coup and remains in effect. There are restrictions on any meetings considered of a political nature or activities deemed critical of the junta. Freedom of the press has been restricted. Pavini Chumsri, with the organization Thai Lawyers for Human Rights, says in light of the situation, it was deemed prudent to comply with the authorities' request to stop the event. Pavini says the groups consider the call to cancel the event a violation of their freedom of expression and the right of citizens to receive information about the human rights situation in the country. She promised the report on human rights in Thailand would be released by other means in the near future. The organizations have been poised to detail complaints to the hotline of the lawyers' organization regarding alleged human rights violations during the first 100 days under the junta. General Prayut Chan-o-cha, the army chief who deposed Thailand's civilian government, said on Tuesday the junta will focus on internal security now that the cabinet is taking office. He also stated martial law needs to remain in effect for now to maintain order. An appointed legislature handpicked by the army chief last week unanimously approved the general as the country's prime minister. 12 members of the Prayut cabinet are active or retired officers of the security forces. Some international rights organizations have condemned the Thai military's detention of politicians, activists, and journalists. Most of those held have been released after a week or less with warnings, but some face criminal charges. The junta says its mission is to return happiness to the Thai people after an extended period of political turmoil. General Prayut has promised general elections before the end of next year after a sweeping reform of the country's political structure. Steve Herman, VOA News, Bangkok.
The death toll from an Ebola outbreak in the Northern Democratic Republic of Congo has risen to 31. Health Minister Philippe Kabange-Numbi says officials have recorded a total of 53 confirmed and suspected cases of Ebola in the Djera district of Equator province. The outbreak is believed to be unrelated to the one in West Africa, which has killed more than 1,500 people this year. The United Nations says that outbreak has put harvests at risk and sent regional food prices soaring. The UN Food and Agriculture Organization issued the warning today in a special alert for Liberia, Sierra Leone, and Guinea, the three countries most affected by the Ebola outbreak. The FAO said that in those three countries, quarantine zones and restrictions on people's movement aimed at combating the virus have seriously curtailed the movement and marketing of food. The agency said this has led to panic buying, food shortages, and major price increases for some commodities, especially in urban areas. The three U.S. detainees held in North Korea were permitted to speak with foreign media Monday. The government of Kim Jong-un restricted the topics of the questions, and the interviews in Pyongyang were limited to 5 minutes. Each of the men asked Washington to send a representative to Pyongyang to secure his release. VOA's Carolyn Pursuti has our story.
The three Americans, Matthew Miller, Jeffrey Fowle, and Kenneth Bay, each called for the U.S. government to send a special envoy to negotiate his freedom. Bay said, "The only hope that I have is to have someone from the U.S. to come." Of the three, Bay is the only one who has been tried. He is serving a 15-year sentence of hard labor, possibly at one of these prison camps, although he says he's the only one besides the guards who are at the camp. Bay is a Christian missionary who was arrested while leading a group of tourists. Bay's family visited Washington earlier this year to work for his release. His mother, Young Hee Bay, watched her son's latest interview and came away with the same plea.
I really wanted it to happen right now because his body is no longer taken. Long imprisonment in labor camp. His body taken big toll. His body looked like it shrank a lot for me, and his back ache, and even he got a sleep disorder. So I really ask our government to act now.
Please help me in welcoming home Laura Ling and Yuna Lee.
The last time the United States negotiated a North Korean prisoner release was in 2009 when former President Bill Clinton returned with journalist Laura Ling and Una Lee. David Straub, the former director of the State Department's Korea desk, assisted Clinton with the negotiations. He says this time the North Koreans are misjudging their leverage.
If I were still in the U.S. government, I would be reluctant to be a party to sending extremely senior Americans to pick up Americans who've been incarcerated. At what point can you continue to do that? At what point does this become a benefit to the North Koreans, allowing them at any point to blackmail the United States?
Straub says last month a secret U.S. mission to North Korea was unsuccessful in getting the three men freed. He thinks the Koreans want to put more pressure on the U.S. government to send a higher-level government official. On Monday, State Department spokesperson Jen Psaki issued a statement asking Pyongyang to pardon Bae and grant him amnesty so he can return home and receive medical care. During his interview, Jeffrey Fowle called his situation desperate. Fowle is accused of leaving a Bible in his hotel room. Matthew Miller allegedly tore up his visa and demanded asylum in North Korea. Both men said they expect their trials to begin within a month. Carolyn Presutti, VOA News, Washington.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's voanews.com. Online news for a changing world.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. The internet and rapidly evolving technology is quickly changing how people receive news and how journalists deliver it. There are now more ways to tell a story than ever before. One school in Los Angeles is teaching the next generation of journalists with the help of a state-of-the-art newsroom. Elizabeth Lee has this report.
When Faith Miller wanted to study journalism in college, she didn't realize how hands-on the experience would be.
I did not expect that in school I would be reporting on real stories, and I did not know how much work goes into it.
We begin with breaking news.
Unlike their counterparts of past generations, students at the University of Southern California Annenberg School of Journalism learn to deliver news across all platforms, including television, radio, and the web. And that's not all, says Willow Bay, director of the School of Journalism.
Today, we expect journalists to be able to use all sorts of technological tools to research stories, to vet that research, to analyze that research. We expect them to be fluid in multimedia storytelling skills. We expect them increasingly to be their own marketing and distribution arms, to get their stories in front of audiences and to spread those stories as far as they can.
They learn all those skills in a brand new media center built like a modern newsroom. There is a circular assignments desk in the middle of the center with television monitors overhead broadcasting on different channels. More than 90 workstations are spread out around the room where student journalists who work on TV, radio, and the web, collaborate side by side. Digital journalism professor Robert Hernandez says future journalists must also be tech savvy, and that means learning basic computer programming languages.
They need to know how the web works and be able to tinker with it.
Hernandez demonstrates some of the modern tools web reporters can use to tell stories in a different way.
You can do 360 panorama through your phone, right? We can talk about what a tornado looks like, how it rips trees out of the ground. Through their phone, there's an app to kind of stitch that together.
Students can also take a class that experiments with Google Glass, a device that connects to the internet and records video and audio. Will Fetterman is a print and digital journalism student.
I think we're entering a market now where if you don't have kind of a wide range of skills and have a little bit of knowledge of everything, you're probably going to have a difficult time finding a job.
The next person to come up with...
The goal is not just to prepare students for the real world, but to also make them savvy enough to adapt quickly to changing technology. But with new technology comes new ethical questions, and future journalists should tread carefully, says the Media Center's executive director, Serena Cha.
In the journalism arena, we've got to consider carefully, how do we teach students to use the tools responsibly? So yes, new technology often raises new questions because you're able to manipulate reality even more than before.
Faculty members say at the core of all this technology, students still need to learn traditional journalism, how to write and tell a compelling story that is accurate, fair, and balanced. Elizabeth Lee for VOA News, Los Angeles.
Thanks for watching Annenberg TV News.
From everyone here at ATVN, you can watch us on the web at atvn.org. Good night.
Newsrooms are always busy no matter where they are. Well, thanks for joining us today for International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington.
This is Today in History. On September 2nd, 1666, the Great Fire of London broke out. When the blaze was finally extinguished, 4 days later, more than 80% of the city had been destroyed. Tens of thousands of people were made homeless, but amazingly, few were killed. In 1789, an act of the U.S. Congress created the Department of the Treasury to manage the revenue of the United States government. The department produces paper currency and coins for circulation. It also collects federal taxes. In 1859, a huge solar storm affected telegraph service in the U.S. A similar storm today would have a catastrophic effect on broadcast and internet communications. On this day in 1945, Japan formally surrendered to Allied forces, ending World War II. U.S. Army General Douglas MacArthur presided over the surrender ceremony aboard the battleship USS Missouri, which was anchored in Tokyo Bay. MacArthur was appointed by President Truman to oversee the Allied occupation of post-war Japan. Hours after Japan's surrender, Vietnamese communist leader Ho Chi Minh declared his country's independence from France, but it would take 30 more years for a unified communist Vietnam to become a reality. By the way, Ho Chi Minh also died on this date 24 years later in 1969. In 1792, during the September massacres of the French Revolution, rampaging mobs slaughtered three Roman Catholic bishops, more than 200 priests, and prisoners believed to be royalist sympathizers. Many men, women, and children were slaughtered in the September massacres. I'm Dave DeForest with VOA's Today in History.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States does not recognize the legitimacy of the so-called presidential elections conducted in the Abkhazia region of Georgia on August 24th and will not acknowledge their outcome, said U.S. State Department spokesperson Jen Psaki. The United States, along with the vast majority of nations, does not recognize the breakaway Georgian provinces of Abkhazia and South Ossetia as independent states. Russia, which fought a short war with Georgia in 2008 related to escalating tensions over the separatist region of South Ossetia, does, and thousands of Russian troops remain in the territories. At a State Department briefing, Ms. Psaki said the U.S. position on Abkhazia and South Ossetia remains clear. These regions are integral parts of Georgia. We once again urge Russia to fulfill all of its obligations under the 2008 ceasefire agreement, including withdrawal of its forces to pre-conflict positions, reversal of its recognition of the Georgian regions as independent states, and provision of free access for humanitarian assistance to these regions. In addition, State Department spokesperson Psaki said, "We renew our full support for the Geneva international discussions as a means to achieving concrete progress on security and humanitarian issues that continue to impact the communities on the ground in Georgia."
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. If you have a comment, please write to Editorials, VOA, Washington, D.C., 20237, USA. You may also comment and view all our current editorials at the VOA Editorials homepage, www.voanews.com/editorials.